Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 25. Malicious Animal Magnetism. Sooner or later, in traversing the lives of those who, like Mary Baker Eddy, lay claim to original thought, it becomes necessary to turn aside long enough to make sure that we understand their definitions. In other words, to make sure that when they use an expression or group of expressions, such use means the same to them that it does to us, and vice versa. The field of research along the major roads and bypaths of the human mind has extended enormously since 1878. At that time, Freud and his school were still 30 years below the horizon. The word behaviorism had not been coined. The word propaganda still found no place outside the sacred congregation of the Vatican. And no one had thought of asking why we behave as human beings. At that time, no one was heard to speak of mass mesmerism, and although fashion, devotion, patriotism, every kind of human emotion, then as now, came and went, no one had ever thought of attributing such movements to anything but specific and most reasonable causes. Even today, research has not attempted to go much beyond the bounds of analysis. The ways and means by which the new propaganda attains its ends have been thoroughly investigated and are pretty well known, but no effective general antidote has ever been found, if it has ever been sought. Today, books are written on the use of mesmerism or suggestion or personal magnetism in the art of salesmanship or of making friends. There is not a failing or foible of human nature which has not been analyzed to the end that means might be discovered for its exploitation. Yet, in spite of all this, the average man is satisfied to believe that his thoughts originate with himself, that his likes and dislikes are his own, uninfluenced by anything but his own intelligence and reasoned judgment. The fashions of yesterday and his changed views in regard to them are always there to have him in derision. But his confidence in himself and in the sovereignty of his choice is never impaired. That far back, Mrs. Eddy reached the conviction that all final power is mental or spiritual. She reasoned, logically enough, that inasmuch as the power that moved the muscles of her hand to write, of her limbs to walk, was purely mental, then there was at least nothing incongruous in the assumption that the power which controlled all the actions and changes of matter, from the stars above to the earth beneath, might be mental also. From this point, she went on to see that if this proposition which she embodied in the statement, "All is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation," were true, then, like all truths, there could be an untruth told about it. In other words, a counterfeit or supposititious opposite, and that the higher anyone attained in the realm of truth, the more obtrusive would be the untruth or the counterfeit which could be brought to light by the discovery. This counterfeit of truth, of the divine mind, as she called it, in all its manifestations, she declared to be the human mind. And from that she went on to maintain that, first and last, this human mind was a state of mesmerism from which the mortal needed to be awakened. The moment, however, she had proved that this divine mind could waken the mortal out of the mesmerism of pain and disease, anger, sorrow, or what not, that moment there arose in a more aggressive form than ever before the counterfeit contention of the opposite of truth, namely, that it could induce or reimpose these limitations. The whole of human belief has been always unconsciously insisting on just this. But the work, Mrs. Eddy maintained, became much more rapid and effective when it was done consciously. The normal action of human belief to maintain its own convictions and standards, she called animal magnetism. And the conscious attempt to make use of this power by the individual for injury of others, she called malicious animal magnetism, or malicious mental malpractice. There is, of course, nothing in all this but what is a commonplace in the study of psychology today. Where Mrs. Eddy clearly differs from the psychologist is in her contention, first, that this mental influence can operate directly and without physical implementation, and second, that an understanding of the supposititious nature of this human mind and a realization of the reality and ever-presence of the divine mind are a complete protection against the mesmeric influence of the former and a demonstration of the actuality and presence of the latter. In brief, Mrs. Eddy, instead of taking it for granted that the sudden inexplicable hatreds, disloyalties, and subterfuges which were constantly coming to light among her followers were simply part of the changes and chances of human life, in the presence of which she was helpless, insisted that they were the result of directed effort on the part of an individual or individuals, and of failure of the student to guard himself against such imposition. In the conspiracy to murder case, she maintained that she had support enough for her thesis. If it is possible to imagine a group of people being separately, expertly mesmerized, in the manner of the public exhibitions of that period, or in the manner of the more serious experiments of the modern clinic, and then willed to conduct a similar case, the result could hardly have been more fantastic than that which actually took place in Boston in the 80s. The nightmare of some plethoric judge is an apt enough description. It seemed to Mrs. Eddy that there must be some reason for it all, other than what appeared on the surface. And so she began to formulate her theory, and 2 years later, in the third edition of her book, Science and Health, under the title Demonology, she considers in some detail the various attacks that had been made upon her and her teaching and upon the movement that she was fostering, from the first open break with Richard Kennedy to the final defection of Spofford, culminating in the incoherent medley of the conspiracy to murder trial. She considers it all from the mental standpoint. The actual translation of the thought into a deed is to her of secondary importance. She dismisses the overt act with the same logical inconsequence as did Jesus when he declared, "Ye have heard it said of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, whosoever looketh upon a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." The man who, taking life as he knows it in his stride, indulges his hatred, his anger, his meanness, his cruelty, his fear, and what not, in simple ignorance, believing that these feelings and emotions are just his own and cannot injure save insofar as they are translated by him into specific deeds, Mrs. Eddy regards simply as an ignorant mental malpractitioner. In other words, he is a man who is thinking wrongly through ignorance and not from malice aforethought. He is ignorant of the fact that the atmosphere of fear or hatred or cruelty he carries around with him is contagious, or in the words of the modern psychologist, stampeding in its effect. The man, on the other hand, who knows what he is doing, has confidence in the dynamic power of thought, and deliberately uses his knowledge to produce the evil effect, Mrs. Eddy calls a malicious mental malpractitioner, and his practice, malicious mental malpractice. He is a man who practices wrongly, not from ignorance, but with malicious purpose. It is a long chapter, this chapter on demonology, some 13,000 words. And in the light of all that is known today regarding the mass application of suggestion and the effect of skillfully imposed propaganda, makes strangely interesting reading. There is but one possible way, Mrs. Eddy writes, of doing evil through a mental method of treating disease. And this is mesmerism, that controls the mind with error instead of truth. Whoever has witnessed the exhibitions of mesmerism has seen it stiffen a joint, suspend thought, produce pain, and move the individual mind to whatever issues intended, proving beyond a doubt that by mortal mind alone the body can be affected injuriously. Falsehoods uttered aloud can be met with rebutting testimony, but a silent mental process of impregnating into the mind and thence into the body, suffering, disease, fear, hatred, sensuality, etc., is Satan let loose, the sin that standeth in holy places, more subtle than all other beasts of the field, a crime at which everyone should shudder, either to become the victim or the perpetrator. The essence of her contention, of course, is that the wider the field opened up by metaphysics in the realm of mind, the wider must, of necessity, be the field opened up to its counterfeit. And so she writes again, "The individual who employs his developed mental powers, like an escaped felon, to commit atrocities according to opportunity, is safe at no period. God hath laid his hand upon him. Justice is manacling him. From physics to metaphysics is full many a league in the line of light. But from the use of inanimate drugs to pass to the misuse of mortal mind is to drop from the platform of manhood into the mire of folly and iniquity. From first to last, the whole chapter is the negative view of her faith. It is, however, important that its purport should be grasped in some measure, because of the tremendous part this teaching, or its misapprehension, played in the immediate subsequent history of the movement. The third edition of Science and Health represents what may be called the high point in the negative presentation of Christian Science. In every later edition, a movement is made towards the positive side. Mesmerism can make mortals believe a lie, but metaphysics can make them unbelieve it, is the keynote of the third edition. Keep your minds so filled with truth and love that sin, disease, and death cannot enter them, is the keynote of the last. In 1879, it was the teaching of the third edition that held the place of emphasis.